I am interested in asking the burning question, how can the R-modes prevent crust formation? This is not the question that people have been asking most of the time since Lars and Greg Ushimirsky kicked off this line of thought 9 months ago or so. It's tended to be the other way around, that people have thought that the crust kills the R-modes. But I think now we've got some signs that this is the interesting question to ask. I'll say, in the spirit of just surveying the basic relevant physics and kicking off lots of discussions, I'm not going to go into a whole lot of detail. Since Lars and Greg's paper, there have been something like a dozen papers in the last 9 months or so. I'm going to be very basic here. If you do want more details, I suggest one place you can look is this paper, which I worked on with Lee Lindblom and Greg Ushimirsky. This is the latest in the series of R-mode crust papers. It's also the longest because we went to some effort to sum things up, at least as they stood in June. Yes, things do change that fast. So if you're interested in an intro to the literature, this is a good place to start. Now, the answer to the question, how can the R-modes prevent crust formation, is in three words, boundary layer heating. There are two cases that you get this, actually. You can have a viscous boundary layer, or you can do a calculation for a turbulent boundary layer. Most people, and I, have been talking about the viscous boundary layer. Yan Chen will actually talk about the turbulent case in the next talk. I should say, before I go on to talk about the viscous case, that this is the boundary layer is almost certainly turbulent, I think. But a lot of the interesting results will carry over from the viscous case, and the viscous case is a bit simpler to deal with. As we'll see later on, the answer is that for a possibly interesting set of circumstances, there's no crust and no boundary layer, so it's a bit of a moot point. And the young neutron stars. Now, before I get into that, let's go back to the beginning and ask so before anyone paid attention to R-modes, how did neutron star crusts form? The first thing to note is that only the outer layers of a neutron star will ever solidify. You need to get densities below a critical density of order, say, 1.5 times 10 to the 14 grams per cubic centimeter. The reason for this is that in order to form a crystalline lattice, you need positively charged nuclei. As you get deeper in the star, as you get denser, the fluid becomes more and more neutron rich to the point where you don't have enough protons running around to do this. It's fluid at any temperature. A very important number, it turns out, now is that even in the outer layers of the star, you need to be below a certain melting temperature. I'm taking a value of about 10 to the 10 kelvins is typical. 10 to the 10 at the base of the crust. It goes down a bit as you go out in the crust, roughly as density the 1/3. It's a bit more complicated than that. Neutron star crusts are actually very complicated objects. They're like onions. There are lots of different layers of different elements, very heavy nuclei that you get from neutron or electron captures occurring at various depths. So the density, the melting temperature, all the things you're interested in tend to jump around a bit on this scaling. But I should say that this figure of 10 to the 10 kelvins, which I'm going to take as typical, is actually probably pretty high. For the melting temperature, there's a composition dependence that I'm not mentioning here, and several other things, but this is a very conservative estimate. That is conservative in the sense that it's the worst for the R mode. If the melting temperature goes down from this, things get very interesting, as we'll see later on. The last important number for crust formation is the time that it takes to happen. That is, if you start the clock for a neutron star, you no longer call it a proto-neutron star. At the moment it becomes transparent to neutrinos, this is a temperature of roughly 10 to the 11 kelvins. From this point on, the neutron star is cooling by neutrino emission, the modified Erka process. and you put in the numbers, it takes about 30 seconds to get down to 10 to the 10 kelvins. By this clock, the R mode has become unstable at less than 1 second, and the growth time scale for a rapidly rotating star is also about 30 seconds. So whatever initial R mode you get after this thing has come out of its bubbling, boiling protoneutron star state has time to grow somewhat. Now, as you change the melting temperature, I didn't display it here, but the scaling is temperature to the minus 6. So if the melting temperature goes down a bit, you can easily have many growth time scales for the R mode to grow by many factors of E from its initial value. But I'm going to stick with the conservative numbers. Ignoring the R modes, back in the good old days, what you had for a neutron star after a pretty short time was the following sort of representative wedge. Out of a total radius of maybe 12 kilometers, don't believe it too much, it depends on the equation of state, but 12 is sort of typical of what people think. Maybe the last 1 or 2 kilometers of that is going to be a solid crust. There will be a very thin ocean of a few meters, and then there's the magnetosphere and all that stuff that I won't concern myself with here. The vast majority of the star is down in this fluid core, where it's mostly neutrons, or maybe some funny particles way down near the center. If you look at, instead of looking at lengths, you look at the mass, which is what couples to gravitational radiation, the discrepancy is even bigger. Only 5% of the mass is in the crust, and of order 95% of it is down in the fluid core, which is why in the ancient days of 1998, we neglected the crust when we were doing our dissipation calculation. Now, what Lars and Greg reminded us of late last year is that in this problem, size does not matter. A lot of the most interesting stuff is going on in an extremely thin boundary layer between the fluid core and the solid crust. That's true. This is just, I just put numbers for the mass and for the radius. If you calculate the current quadrupole moment, which is where most of the coupling is coming from, the dominant stuff for the polytrope, the dominant region is 70 to 80% of the way out. So it's a kilometer or two down from the crust. It's nice in the sense that it's not in the crust and it's not deep enough in that we have to worry about pions or other funny particles being present. We can do pretty well with the nuclear density stuff. If the crust is rigid, you lose some mode energy, and if it's moving, you get some other numbers. If you're interested in the numbers, they're in this paper that I pointed to at first. It's roughly a factor of 2 or even a little bit less, I believe, in the mode energy. The dissipation or the gravitational wave driving time scales go from, say, 3 seconds to 4 seconds, for example, for polytrope. So since all of the interesting stuff is going on in the boundary layer now, let's look at a close-up. The key idea here is that in real fluids, not perfect fluids, the velocity field has to obey a no-slip boundary condition. That is, whatever velocity you've got going on down in the core, the good old-fashioned R-mode velocity, delta V, it has to go down to zero at the crust-core boundary. And in general, it's going to go down to zero very rapidly on a length scale that you can work out from the coefficient of shear viscosity that appears in the Navier-Stokes equations. For young neutron stars, hot neutron stars around 10 to the 10 Kelvin, this number for sort of thickness of the boundary layer turns out to be roughly 10 to the minus 2 centimeters. Earlier today, Grigory Shamirsky was mentioning numbers of order a centimeter. That's because of the temperature scaling. He was looking at 10 to the 8th kelvins, but it's the same thing, exactly the same thing. Now, you can simply write out the Navier-Stokes equations, linearized, of course, just to order alpha, and you can solve them with the right boundary condition to get the delta V in the boundary layer. You get a fairly complicated expression, which I will not write out here. Again, if you're interested, you can find it in the literature. But qualitatively, it behaves about as you would expect. That is, the total delta V is now equal to the old-fashioned R mode delta V plus a boundary layer piece that exactly cancels out the old delta V at the boundary. And as you go away from the boundary into the core, the extra piece decays exponentially on a length scale that's about this, 10 to the minus 2 centimeters. And there's some angular variation to account for the Coriolis force, which you can work out. In this qualitative manner, then, you can say the shear part of the gradient of the velocity field now, instead of going as delta V over R, radius of the star, as it did in the purely fluid case people looked at in 98, now we're looking at a shear that goes as delta V over D. If you work out the dissipation integral for the power going out in shear, this goes up by a factor of R over D, which is 10 to the 7, 10 to the 8, a huge number. It makes the shear time scales competitive with the gravitational radiation time scales. And this caused a lot of excitement. If you actually put in the delta V, which I have not written out, and you grind through all of the algebra, you can work out the dissipation integrals and plug into the machinery that Lee Lindblom talked about in his introductory talk yesterday. And at the end, when the T. Yeah. Yeah, so what... The volume goes down by factor R over D. So. Yeah. So you plug this into the machinery, you get a new set of viscous timescales. The first interesting thing you see is that now there's, instead of going as temperature squared, the time scales go linearly with temperature. That's because of the temperature dependence of the thickness of the boundary layer. And there's also a frequency dependence for the boundary layer, and that gives you a frequency dependence in the new viscous time scales. The numbers out in front also change. The time scales get to be much shorter. If you're looking at a temperature of about 10 to the 10 kelvins, for neutron-neutron scattering, which is your ordinary fluid viscosity above the superfluid transition temperature, which is around 10 to the 9 kelvins, for that case, the typical time scale is 5 times 10 to the 3 seconds. This number's for an n equals 1 polytrope. It changes a bit, actually by a surprisingly small amount, much less than a factor of 2 if you change to various other equations of state. If you go below the superfluid transition temperature of 10 to the 9 kelvins, you really have to account for the changed hydrodynamics that you get with a superfluid. No one's really done that yet, but a very crude way of doing it is to simply change the viscosity coefficient to electron-electron scattering, and then it's a couple times 10 to the 3 seconds. Now, the logical thing to do with these numbers is plug them into a new version of the instability curve, which everyone has been graphing for the last day and a half. If you do this, you get the following very interesting result. Instability curves. I've drawn three instability curves here. This is purple line here is for the purely fluid case that was talked about in 98. This is the critical angular velocity with the equation of state dependence scaled out versus temperature for purely fluid neutron star. Above this line, the m equals 2 R mode is unstable. Below this line, the mode's stable. If you add in a rigid crust and you work through the numbers, you get this red curve, which actually looks kind of brown on this transparency. I guess the ink's a bit thick. Again, this is just a number for the polytrope. You get a very high instability curve for a rigid crust. This abrupt switch is because I've changed from electron-electron scattering to neutron-neutron scattering here. You see that if the crust is rigid, it's a pretty dramatic result. What people originally thought was that the R modes are just dead in the Lomas X-ray binaries because they all live around here somewhere. They've got to be completely stable if this is true. And young neutron stars are going to come in, they're going to be born up here if they're spinning very rapidly. They're going to come in and pretty quickly within a few minutes, hit this stability curve if there's a crust and a viscous boundary layer. This green curve I've drawn is if you allow for crust motion, as Greg was talking about earlier today, you can have the crust-core coupling making the crust move along almost with the core. So well, calling it the slip velocity is maybe a bad idea, but the amount of velocity that has to get changed over the boundary layer goes down by a factor of 10 in the case where you've got crust-core coupling. Roughly a 10. I just put in as Greg showed, there's a funny frequency dependence. I just put in a straight factor of 10, and that's interesting because that gets you down to the interesting range for low mass X-ray binaries again. All this is what you get if there is a crust and if there is a viscous boundary layer. Now I'm going to argue that in some interesting cases for young neutron stars, you don't get a crust, at least not in the normal sense. So while the amount of energy dissipated in the shear has gone up by a factor of, say, 10 to the 8 when you look at a viscous boundary layer over the pure fluid case, the volume that this energy is getting dissipated in has gone down by a factor of 10 to the 8, which means you've got a tremendous amount of localized heating. So if the R mode is big enough, this localized heating can heat the boundary layer and the crust back up to melting temperature. And so it's a very interesting question to ask. What does it take to heat the boundary layer up to melting temperature? You can do this crude estimate that says it happens for a fairly small value of alpha. You can do a better estimate by actually solving the heat equation. The idea here is that after a few minutes, because the temperature dependence of the cooling time scale is so steep, after a few minutes, the rest of the star has cooled a little bit below melting temperature. You can consider it to be almost stationary. So you just solve a quasi-equilibrium heating equation where you have the R mode heating. You can treat it as a delta function localized in the boundary layer. The R mode heating has to balance out the cooling due to neutrino emission and conduction away from this boundary layer. What you get when you solve this heat equation, you plug in numbers. You plug in typical numbers for thermal conductivity in the core and in the crust, neutrino emissivity by Urca cooling in the core, Bremsstrahlung in the crust. You get a temperature profile that looks like this. It peaks up at the boundary layer, as you would expect. If you work through the numbers for the R mode shear heating, it turns out that the viscous boundary layer gets held at the melting temperature if the R mode amplitude exceeds a critical value, which for the viscous boundary layer case is about 5 × 10⁻³. This is an interesting number because it's pretty small. You can easily imagine that an R mode has time to grow that big, or maybe it's even born almost that big when it's coming out of this very perturbed protoneutron star object. And a very interesting feature of this number is that if you take the melting temperature down a little bit, the critical amplitude for melting goes down. There's a 5/2 dependent on temperature. And as I said before, because the temperature dependence of the cooling time scale is so dramatic, it's going to take much longer for the crust to form, and you can easily get in, say, an order of 10 E-folding time scales if that temperature goes down by a factor of 2 or so. So that means that assuming that there's some very large nonlinear hydro or whatever mysterious saturation effect going on in the purely fluid star, the R mode can easily grow to that value by the time the crust forms. I should say, you have to actually divide this number by the slip velocity if the crust moves. These numbers are for rigid crust. So if the slip velocity goes down by a factor of 10, this critical amplitude goes up by a factor of 10. A similar thing happens. Oh, yes. I should have said this omega zero is square root of pi g rho. That's all. The length scale on which the temperature falls off is it's of order 10^100 times the thickness of the boundary layer. So by the time you've gone a couple of centimeters away from the boundary layer, you're down to the equilibrium temperature of the neutron star, whatever that is. in this heat equation, you can effectively treat the rest of the neutron star as a sink. So it doesn't matter. That's one very nice feature of this, is the profile in the region we're interested in looks the same, independent of what the rest of the neutron star is doing. I don't know. We haven't looked at it. Yeah, this is all done without magnetic fields. So, okay, so you said the crust or the quasi-crust or whatever you get. That's actually one of the most interesting results of what people have been looking at lately. What I just quoted was a number, a critical value of the Armod amplitude that gets the crust heated back up to the melting temperature. Now, it can't actually melt. We spent some time scratching our heads wondering what happens in that case, and then Lee, in the middle of a Montana winter, I guess, was looking at his bathtub and came up with the idea of an ice pack. This is a really cute idea because it's incredibly robust. One of the problems I haven't mentioned so far, although other people have alluded to it, is that with neutron star physics, all of the important numbers have huge error bars on them. This mechanism doesn't care about the error bars. The basic idea is that you have nowhere to go but the melting temperature. That is, if you let the temperature of the outer layer of the star go down a little below melting temperature, you get a solid crust forming, then the boundary layer heats it back up. If you have the temperature fluctuate up a little bit above melting, then it melts. It's just fluid. You've removed your heat source. There's no more boundary layer, so it has to cool back down. So you're stuck at the melting temperature in some sort of solid fluid equilibrium, otherwise known as an ice pack. The idea here is now that in this mixed solid fluid state, you have all of these chunks of ice floating around in the flow, which is largely going as the ordinary fluid R mode did. You have these chunks of ice bobbing around and occasionally colliding with each other, and there's no boundary layer because of that. The viscosity, the extra viscosity that you're getting is entirely due to collisions between chunks of ice. Now you can do a more detailed calculation of this. You can put down some mean chunk size and some mean free path between the chunks, work out a lot of the gory details. It turns out to be actually not so much like an Arctic ice pack, but more like what people have done for ice particles in the rings of Saturn, but it still works. So down in the core, it's just fluid. In the outer layers, it's fluid with chunks of ice floating around. The chunks of ice are banging into each other, and that's where the dominant viscosity comes from.
So what's different? Is it the mean velocity of the chunks is basically the R mode velocity.
So you've got liquid and you've got solid. I'm asking, what is physically the difference between the stuff in the liquid state and the solid? Is it hotter? Is it different nuclear length? What is it?
It's that you have a crystalline lattice in the solid stuff and that you don't in the liquid stuff. It's all about at melting temperature. Like, you have a glass of ice water, the ice and the water are the same temperature. It's just, well, I believe there is a little density shift as well. Yeah. It's pretty short. It turns out to be something like of order an orbital period, or of order an R mode period. The thing is, these things have very inelastic collisions. They're constantly growing as they lose heat, locally growing. Then they hit each other and they break up or disintegrate because the kinetic energy is big compared to the heat of melting, the heat of fusion. You can work out some rough numbers for the details of it.
But
Right. So what happens is if the chunk size, so you can, if they're too small, there's not enough viscosity. So that's this line. The chunk size, the details, the chunk size and the mean free path have to adjust themselves. So the first thing is that the chunk size and the mean free path have to be about the same size. If you have chunks that are much bigger than the mean free path between them, the whole thing freezes and locks up. If you have little tiny chunks with a huge mean free path, then you don't get much additional viscosity. So now you're down to one parameter, and this parameter adjusts itself. It has to adjust itself because it's got nowhere to go, so that the viscous heating due to these ice collisions exactly balances the neutrino cooling and keeps you right at the melting temperature. You can work out numbers for this. It turns out at alpha equals 1, if you're spinning near the breakup velocity, the chunk size is of order a centimeter or so. And as you get a less of an R-mode velocity field, so as you reduce alpha and omega, you need bigger chunks of ice to maintain the same viscosity. Because it always has to balance the neutrino cooling, which doesn't care what the R-mode is doing.
Well, let me ask a question at this point. So you need a radial viscosity. So my question is, if the ice chunks are moving, then you have to have something that will just transport the radial direction.
Right. Yeah, they just bump into each other. They just grind up against each other. That's enough. So actually, in the outer layers, even when it's fluid, you've still got these nuclei running around. They just can't stick together because they're too hot. So it's actually bremsstrahlung. So it's down by a factor of, what is it, 1,000 or a few hundred from ERCA. Right. There are temperature fluctuations within this. This equality just holds on a large scale as you've averaged over many chunks. It's like a glass of ice water. They're the same temperatures, as the extra, the heat difference is all locked up in the heat of fusion. So yes. Yeah. Or what would be the crust if you let it? Well, yeah, I guess Hensel's latest claim is that there's a 1% density jump when you solidify. So
all the way up or all the way down, depending on the density.
roughly, I mean.
How about if we let, say, one question until after this? Just one. Everyone got one question. Otherwise, I think we should let them finish.
You'd like to suggest that question?
I will.
All right, so it's no big deal. I'm almost at the end anyway. So yeah, as you can see, there are some of these details that we only worked out very roughly or didn't work out, because you're stuck at melting temperature by the argument I gave above. The one thing, so when you go in and look at estimates of chunk size, the one interesting number that you get out is that. Because you need bigger chunks to balance neutrino cooling as the star spins down, you do get a final spin down velocity where the chunk size becomes comparable to the radius of the star. So everything locks up. The R mode can no longer maintain this ice pack, and the dissipation sets in and kills it. So that tells you that a young neutron star then spins down in this ice pack state. To a final frequency, you plug in the numbers for this, and it's about 0.09 pi g rho bar if you take alpha to be of order unity, and that's pretty nice, interesting number, because it says that the original purely fluid picture of the spin down is almost unchanged. If you can get an initial amplitude big enough to form this ice pack in the first place. Yeah.
After a second, if you need to get the thing out, it becomes true. What if just putting it out in the sense that a low entropy keep on growing and seeing the star higher, and that becomes higher than the temperature temperature?
You mean, you mean like Yuri's thermal runaway scenario? Right. If the mode's unstable, it'll keep growing. So what's? No, so in the gravitational waves paper, I think this is figure 3. We worked this out, so we worked out the shear heating compared to neutrino cooling from the modified IRCA for the purely fluid case. And it's not an issue until you're down to about 10 to the 9 kelvins. Or maybe it's like 2 times 10 to the 9 kelvins. So if you have just a pure fluid with no boundary layer, the dissipation is not enough to reheat it. Especially not up at above 10 to the 10 kelvins. The whole thing's about the same in this case. Right. So we were using alpha equals 1. Then it only becomes competitive with neutrino cooling around 10 to the 9 kelvins. If alpha is less than 1, then the temperature gets even lower. And because the IRCA process is so temperature dependent, let's see. In order to get it competitive without a boundary layer at 10 to the 10 Kelvin, you should need something like alpha of 10 to the 3, which I don't think many people would believe. So you're asking what's the time it takes for a crust to form, if you don't have an R mode, it's comparable to the time to lose KT per nucleon. I don't remember what that is. It's pretty quick, isn't it, Greg? Do you remember? enough. Well, that's when you've taken the temperature down a bit. We're working at higher temperatures, so it's pretty fast. All right, go ahead. Yeah, that's exactly the message. It just breaks up into little chunks. Yeah, so the idea with this ice pack is that the chunks are pretty much moving with the fluid R mode flow. We haven't looked at magnetic fields.
Just before we ask the question, let's thank Ben for